Welcome back to another episode of Founder Stories. I am super grateful to be able to release this episode after taking a month break to be in Israel, where I had the chance to meet with the startups that I interviewed on this show. Now, let me tell you, if you get the opportunity to go to Israel, I highly advise you to go. You obviously have the historical fact about the country, which is one reason to go. But the second reason is to go check out the Startup Nation. While I was there, I have to say I met probably close to 200 VC firms and startups. And I have to tell you, there is a special energy, incredible innovation that you probably won't find anywhere else in the world. There's really something special about it. And even more so, like if you walk down the streets in Tel Aviv, you'll probably bump into some founder that sold his startup for billions of dollars or some really big VC. And you're able to go ahead and strike up a conversation and really start a friendship. And I could say this from personal experience, which happened on this past trip, but that's the Israeli culture. So if you do get a chance to go, definitely go. And if you're in Tel Aviv, make sure you check out Sirona Market, Rothschild. It's a really, really special place. Now, our guest today is actually someone that while I was there, I had the opportunity to go to his home, to meet his family, and to see how more incredible he is in person. Our guest today is my very dear friend, Ron. Ron is the co-founder of an incredible company which he co-founded together with our mutual friend and his very dear friend, Nitzan, a company called Espagon, which was sold for $500 million to Cisco. I mean, that's mind-boggling, amazing. And even more so, it couldn't have happened to any better two people possible. These two founders are such nice, incredible people. And you're actually going to hear it in Ron's story. So in our conversation, we go into so many different things. His early days, the pivots, what it takes to actually build a company, what it means to actually be PLG, which is product-led growth, and how it felt to start a company and to sell a company, and the whole entire selling process. So it was a phenomenal, phenomenal conversation. I really enjoyed it, and I know you're going to enjoy it too. So have a great listen, and if you did benefit, please subscribe and leave a review. This recording is brought to you by the Goodness and Kindness Foundation. If you're walking down the street, smile to a stranger, do a good deed for someone else. Let's all strive to make our impact in this world in order to make the world a better dwelling place for everyone. This spot right over here is meant for your company. So if your company would like to partner up with the Founder Stories podcast, please reach out to us. Hey everyone, I'm super, super excited today to have with us a very, very special guest and a very, very dear friend. Today, we have the absolute honor to host our dear friend, Ron. Ron is the founder of a company called Espagon. And if you have not heard about them, I highly advise you to go and check them out. Go Google them and find out. Espagon was recently sold for the crazy amount of money of $500 million to Cisco. Phenomenal. And we're going to get into the whole entire story of how he built it up, the challenges that came along the way, and eventually the sale. But not only that, Ron is also the founder of the phenomenal, phenomenal Netflix skip intro button, which is, I think, brilliant. You know, when you have that Netflix, you have the promo and it says skipped intro. Ron invented something that does it for you automatically, an AI bot that's eventually going to give you the transcript of the movie and multiple other things going to get into. But Ron is also the father of a beautiful, beautiful baby, a great husband, and it's just an awesome, all-around, humble, super nice guy, and I'm very privileged to call him a dear friend. So I am super excited to learn not just about how he built this company, but actually who he is himself, and the first thoughts that he wakes up with in the morning of how he grows and how he shows up every single day in his personal life and his married life and everything else he does. So Ron, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. You already shared too much about me. I'm feeling like there is no need for an intro. Like you already said all the good things. So what's next?
Okay, perfect. We can hang up right now. Done.
Bye, everyone.
Wow. Ron, where do we even begin?
Sheesh.
So there's so much going on. I want you to take me, walk me through the day that you signed the agreement, the documents to sell the company to Cisco. Walk me through the emotion that you're going through that day.
Yeah. Many people feel that it's like, you know, like in the movies, somebody come with a suitcase with tons of money and you just sit there for an hour and it's signed. And it's not like that. That takes very long. If you think of, you know, a term sheet that you sign up and, you know, a funding round, which can take up to a month or even several months. So that's take a sweaty several months of highs and lows. And it's really emotional. The signing itself is more of a stress relief. In our case, it's been, you know, several months of due diligence and getting to know both sides and making sure, you know, everything is covered. And, you know, ultimately, as every, you know, agreement, lawful agreement, there are some points that you need to debate, decide up until. Now, I remember waking up into Monday that week of the signature. The signature was on Friday, by the way. I'm waking up on Monday and I'm telling myself, okay, now we're signing up. Next day, we're going to announce to the team. That's perfect. Now, you know, lawyers are pinging back and forth. Comes Tuesday, comes Wednesday. By Wednesday, we told ourselves this is the last day because basically on Israel, we're working up until Thursday, and then Thursday we'll announce to the rest of the team and everybody's happy. Wednesday didn't happen. This was a heartbreaking because it adds a lot of dependencies as a public company, when you can do that and earning calls and so many things that coming into the same time. And we said, oh, we'll need to hold for 2 more weeks. And that's like, if you think of a roller coaster of emotions, that's it. On Thursday, we woke up and, you know, I'm based out of Tel Aviv. My partner and his son is based out of New York, is doing most of the, you know, most of this thing because Cisco is based out of San Francisco. So the time zone really bizarre. It happens 24 hours on different areas in the world. And then by Thursday, you know, I'm already, it's the end of the week in Israel, starting the weekend, Friday. And I remember telling myself, let's hold it a bit more. It's not going to happen today. We're not going to announce the team on Friday. That's, you know, that's not acceptable as we think. But then Itzan told me, look, we're going to make it happen. And I remember almost every day on 3 a.m., I'm waking up to see, you know, through the phone, trying to look a glimpse if something happened. On Thursday, I was so stressed and broken that I told myself, never mind, it's not going to happen this week. Let's hold it a bit more. And then for some reason, I didn't woke up. I didn't put my phone on no sleep because I need to sign up. It's on, need to call me and tell everything is ready, sign up the DocuSign for all of the agreement. And the phone was on, you know, sleep mode. Nothing comes in, no notifications at all. And I'm waking up almost randomly at 5 a.m. in the morning. I see Nitzan calling me on every medium, starting from Facebook calls to WhatsApp to FaceTime, through Slack, through literally any medium that he can call. Even my wife, I tried to call my wife. And I was, what happened? Like, why he calls me so many times? And then I opened WhatsApp, you know, barely can see. It's like you open your eyes and what's going on? I see a message, go into your email now and sign the documents now. I'm like, okay, Google DocuSign, next. And then it's like a stress relief of, I don't know, 4 months of exhaustion. And I'm like, that's done. At the same time, I took like sweatpants and training and I went out running because I felt like, you know, I don't know, 100 pounds are being removed and now I can run freely. I ran, I don't know, the speed of light. I, you know, dissolved all stress for myself and I understood it's happening. So that was it. That was the moment of signature, but it's mostly what happened before that led to this point.
Wow. I can only imagine, you know, forget about the stress aspect, but also holding that information in the whole entire time that the only people know is obviously your wife, your co-founder, your lawyers, maybe your investors too.
Yeah.
But holding that information in from the rest of your family saying, we're just about to have like something that's going to change our life for good almost.
Yeah. It's one of the trickiest part that many founders don't know before that, I also didn't know. When I'm thinking about an exit, I'm pretty sure, you know, in my head, all the employees are, you know, directing to it. It's like a company-wide effort. And it's true, but it's a company-wide effort of founders. All founders should be aimed toward that goal while still presenting to the rest of the employees, you know, 50, 100, hundreds of employees, continue doing what you need to do. Continue that sell to that customer, continue that development of that product feature. And you know that maybe tomorrow it wouldn't be relevant anymore. Maybe tomorrow, you know, will change everything that happens. So that's probably the hardest part about the selling. It's trying or hiding, you know, from the rest of the company, what's really happening behind their feet.
Yeah, it's not like you want to be dishonest. It's just you cannot share that information. That's all it is.
I understand the reason. The reason is confidentiality, which makes sense. It's you don't want these things to be leaked into the media. You don't want it to, you know, mess or ruin the opportunity for this thing. So it makes sense, but at the same time, it's hard to continue the company as it was, you know, regular times. And, you know, sometimes even it doesn't succeed. So what happens if all the company is, you know, focusing on selling itself and then for some reason you can't make it. So everybody will be sad. So it's a very tricky situation. But luckily, I think that in most cases, when it advances to this point, you get to sell the company.
Wow, incredible. So first of all, I am so happy for you. It's amazing. When good things happen to good people, it gives me so much happiness, and especially yourself, and to hear what was going on. But let's take a step back, you know, and start talking about hindsight and thinking about what it was actually like to build a company from the ground up and selling it.
Let's start with the early days. Nitzan and I met in the army, like most of the Israeli founders. We set ourselves into a mission to build something big, you know, speaking about IPO and, you know, bragging about things, but really don't know what to do from the early stages or how to get there or even if it's possible. We had a first idea, you know, which I'll run shortly. It was named Get Talent, hiring or screening candidates, technical candidates in the right way. Not very interesting, but it made us learn a lot and it made us a good couple to continue with. When you're, you know, a couple, even on a marriage, is not being measured when it's successful, it's being measured on the lowlights or the bad things that can outcome or, you know, succeed from together. So we had this, you know, venture that we started 6 months, it didn't work out. And we went then to Epsagon. It started with an ideation that our main focus was how do we take our best selves or what we do best into something that we can build. And when you look on a, you know, the background of Nitzan's and myself, it's, you know, R&D, low level, cybersecurity, infrastructure, cloud. These are the things that we're coming with, you know, I want to say the top percentile, like, you know, people in business coming from Harvard are great. People that are coming from the intelligence forces, usually, you know, it's not everyone, but usually are better because the nature of what's happening in there, the nature of how do we train people, how do we qualify people, how do we promote people. So this is what we're good at. And we try to take it into the Epsagon venture, which wasn't on the previous one. We started ideation around many areas. We tried to find which one can be big. The second thing that we wanted to do this time, unlike the previous one, is to find an area that could be really big. How much big? As big as we can think of. I see many founders, you know, I see the term feature company. You know, let's do, you mentioned the Netflix Keeper. It's not even a feature company. It's just a, you know, when I'm done building great companies, I'm building just, you know, small things to help my day to day. So I find many times founders that not dreaming big enough, dreaming of a relatively small problem, something that is an add-on or a feature. And we didn't want to end up like this. We wanted to think, you know, when you're showing how much TAM, like total addressable market, and what's the size of the market, and what's Gartner says, and what's, you know, all the CAGR and the rest of, we wanted it to be as big as it can be. Some numbers that, you know, even your 0.1%, you're still big enough to become a big company. That was the monitoring landscape. We saw tremendous success there. We saw every time that there are new companies that rising on new technologies, and that's where we set up to start Epsagon. Early on the days, we were focusing just on serverless, monitoring serverless. We saw a big gap and a big pain. We talked to hundreds of customers, or not just hundreds of potential customers, not necessarily real customers, and understand there is a big pain and there is a big gap that we need to solve. And that's like the first days of Epsagon.
So I love that you focused on two things over there that you did. First of all, you know, really utilizing your background, like where you come from, your strong suit. And the second thing was mentioning you don't want to think small. You wanted to think big. And, you know, big was you weren't limiting your imagination of what you'd be able to accomplish.
Yeah.
It's funny because a lot of times as human beings, like sometimes we're afraid to think big about the fact how, for A, how people are going to think we're very foolish. But then also it's like we're afraid to fool ourselves also.
Yeah, I agree. It's challenging to not think outside of the box, but it's challenging to think big. You always think of just the next step or the next two steps. As a founder, I think one of the good traits of a good founder is not to solve fire problems like what's happening right now, but to think how the organization will look in the next couple of years, what's the roadmap looks, what's the innovation looks like within that organization. Try to think about the end state rather than how do I solve the next hiring? How do I solve the next feature or the next customer that we want to close one? And that's something that we learned along the way, that if you aim, for example, to be a big company, start to address from the end all the way to the beginning, what it means a big company. How many employees? How do I get to that number of employees? How much ARR? How do I get to that number of ARR? What other metrics am I looking for? And carve out a plan towards there instead of, you know, finishing month by month or day by day, all sweaty and just trying to make sure things are not falling apart. Sometimes it's okay to have small things falling apart while you're trying to build, you know, an empire. But if you're not aiming to build an empire and you're just trying to cover this one or two pieces, it's just, you know, you wouldn't get really to the top. It will be something very shallow, something very simple.
Now, I love that aspect. Thinking about, like, you know, what does a big company mean to you and how do you want to get there? You know, sometimes, and if someone wants to build a small company and have like a lifestyle business, that's okay too. Nothing wrong with it. But if you really want to make a massive impact in the world and build something very, very big, you have to go ahead, obviously apply the work and do that. But is that what you did? You sat down and you and Nitan and saying, this is what a big company is. This is how we plan on getting there and everything.
Yeah. So we had in our mind, and, you know, we had previous offers to what we had with Cisco that we either declined or they didn't go to a point where we're really, you know, doing something with it. We understand that a big company is something that would make us proud. What makes us proud? You know, let's say around 100 people company, millions of dollars in ARR, a product that is being widely used and widely known, you know, as much as possible for a startup. I'm not talking about, I don't know, Zoom or something similar. And getting to some expertise on our own mind in some areas that, you know, allows us to be happy with, you know, what we learned about how to sell business to software, how to use the motion of product-led growth and not the sales-driven approaches, learning about the monitoring ecosystem. So really mastering some sort of an area for us that is very important. So I think we covered all. There wasn't like an exact number. You know, it's not like on 90 employees, we're not selling the company, and on 100, yes. But it's some bar that we're aiming. And, you know, I think we hit that point where we said, it's really an interesting venture. It's an amazing opportunity. I mean, you know, even if we would run for, I don't know, a year or two very successfully, probably that offer would still be very meaningful. So, you know, now you can say no to that. And the opportunity, not just to make our lives better, but, you know, the employees, our ecosystem, our friends, happier, it's priceless. You know, it's one thing to do good to yourself, but if you can do good to, I don't know, 60 other employees, it's, for me, you know, I'm just tell me where to sign.
It's one of the differences I see a lot, like in between founders that have employee-centric focused and founders are not. You know, everyone obviously says they're employee focused. And once you have conversations with them, you're able to see obviously the differentiation around it. But I've seen always that a lot of times when founders do put their employees first, when they're number one, you're able to see a difference in the bottom line of the company, you know, and the monetization aspect of it too.
It's a game of people. I think Hepsagon really deserves its win to the employees. You know, I'm not saying it for anyone that will listen, but it really, and I see it on other companies. Companies succeed because of their people, people responsible for the technology, for the product, for being able to execute, for being able to do everything. And without them, we would just be another nice company that maybe sells nicely or whatever, but not as that successful as we've been.
So then I'd love to break down how you became successful or some of the success aspects of it. And also at the same time, love to learn more about the roller coaster ride and the vulnerabilities that came together with it too. And from my understanding, what you mentioned so far is you had the background, you had the TAM, you wanted to build a massive company that's able to make the biggest impact possible, and you had the right co-founder. So everything aligned in place in order to go ahead and build something. But you know, your entrepreneurial experience, you know, one of the things I also want to figure out is that you're not like a, and correct me if I'm wrong, you guys are not tough cookies in the sense of like, let's go hustle it out and go sell and could be incredible. Like, you guys are very relaxed, you know, typical nerdy behind the computer type of quote unquote, you know, stereotype.
Exactly.
So how'd you go about building this and getting all those, that first customer, getting that incredible ARR, what you got and everything?
I think we had been lucky that our target persona was a developer as well, and still is a developer as well. We know him. You know, I've been a developer for a lot of years. Nitzan been a developer for a lot of years. All of our engineers are still developing for a lot of years. Being able to understand the persona on the other end, what he suffers from, how can he buy software, how does he make an impact to the organization, helped us. It's not like, you know, maybe in the cybersecurity ecosystem, you need to, you know, speak to a CISO, you need to take him out to a golf play, you need to take him to a fancy dinner. It doesn't work the same way on developers. Developers are like, oh, why are you calling me? Why don't you give me just the code and I'll run it? Why isn't there a self-serve? When you know our persona very well, and in our case, this persona doesn't need the fancy, salesy, you know, suits. We understood that our motion is more fitted towards PLG, product-led growth. I can get to it. There is a lot to say about that. But I think in very short, it means that the user acquisition, the user retention, and the expansions and upsells are coming mainly from the product. Again, versus the approach of having salespeople speaking or having dinners with their customer. When you understand that, you're just starting to build a product that will suit your customers, or in our case, developers. And we had two things in our mind, really focusing on. One is to be very customer obsessed. You know, the amounts of full story and log rocket sessions that I've watched, I don't know, thousands or tens of thousands, the amount of customers that we spoke to, thousands or tens of thousands. We really wanted to make sure they understand it, they enjoy it, they're getting to their aha moment, they're getting value from the product. Ultimately, it solves the problem for which they came through in the first place. The second thing is to become more analytical. When you're having that amount of traffic, qualitative is not good enough. It's good. You need to run this as well, but you need to be also quantitative. How many people succeed in going through the onboarding, making an upsell opportunity, integrating their application, doing whatever they need to do with Hepsagon? And when it turns to be a data decision, it becomes very easy. You know what doesn't work. The whole conversation is not about, I think that's, or I think this, or I think it's, we're seeing this is the problem. Now let's think together what will solve this problem. So it becomes really helpful. These two things really helped us to shape the product very fast into what it's been today.
It's funny, you're mentioning a lot self-serve and, you know, product-led growth, which is obviously all the hype right now. That, yeah. And the second aspect is obviously the other big hype is community. And mm-hmm. Everyone's talking about how companies have to create community and adopt PLG. product-led growth. Yeah. What are some of the mistakes you guys made and you see? Obviously, we're able to build out product-led growth to become a self-serve and able to work out to certain, you know, it worked out. Let me look where it's gone to. So give us everything around that.
Yeah. I'll share a few of the misconceptions I'm hearing from anyone, from founders, leaders, product people, VCs, and so on. The first and foremost, PLG is not a short-term play. Sales, if you want to get to a higher ROI very fast, just sell, you know, make a few sales, very big ones, you'll be on a very good ARR. PLG is not a short-term plan. If you plan to, you know, run for a year and, you know, bomb yourself with tons of PLG, you know, ARR, it's not that. PLG starts really, really slow, but at some point when you're at the when you're hitting the right threshold and when everything works really great, all of a sudden you're seeing this skyrocket increase. It takes time. It might take even, I don't know, 5 years to get to this point. But once you reach it, you're really growing tremendously. There is that, you know, Bessemer chart of how long it took for some companies to get from $1 million to $100 million. So you're seeing a few companies, I don't know, like Salesforce, etc. It took them a lot of years. And then companies like Twilio or HashiCorp, that it took them, or Slack, took them maybe, I don't know, 3 years to get from 1 million to 100 million, like the classic, I don't know, triple, triple, double, double, double. And, you know, they're tremendously growing. So one misconception is PLG is not a short-term play. It's a very long-term play. The other couple ones that I'm constantly hearing, you know, let's put a free trial button on the website and we're PLG. That doesn't mean that you're PLG. That's one of the things that you're doing in order to become PLG. And that allows customers to use, or potential customers to use, the product in advance. That's one key point, but you need to understand what happens there. It's not like you just open it for signups and hope people understand what happens. It comes with onboarding, with documentation, with best practices and use cases, with a lot of content, technical content. So it takes time to get there. The other two things is, you know, I heard one people told me, I asked him, how do you plan to become a PLG? So he told me, we're going to hire a really good UI UX person and we'll be PLG. And I told him, look, a usable product doesn't mean that it's PLG. Every product should be usable, but you can sell it top down. You can sell it on outbound. You can do many ways of selling. It's not that part of the motion. So there are lots of misconceptions. And I think PLG, it's not like binary. It's not, you're either PLG or not PLG. It has a lot of aspects, as I mentioned, from user acquisitions, which marketing is responsible for, all the way to conversions, which is somewhere between the product and marketing. And then, you know, retention and upselling, which everybody is responsible for, even salespeople. It's okay to have salespeople in a PLG company. It even goes better if you're doing it right. So it has a lot to it. I think that we learned along the way, you know, for Epsicon specifically, we learned a lot along the way what works better and what doesn't work so well. Because again, it's not like, you know, there's not like a switch that you're saying, okay, now I'm PLG and it's PLG. It's okay, let's try that approach within marketing. Let's change this part about the product. Let's infuse salespeople into prospects when they're signing up to the product. And let's make sure our customer success calls that, you know, small Fortune 100 company that they bought Epsicon, but for a small number, and see if there is an opportunity for an upsell. So, you know, it's a lot of small switches that can take you there.
It's so true. It's all these little micro things that make a difference in the bigger macro picture. It's all the small little details. So what are the things that you found that have worked by you, by Epsicon, to create that successful PLG?
One of the things that helped us is having an onboarding which is ongoing. That's really a small tip for any, I would say almost any PLG company. Many people think of onboarding as a one-time setup. You just put some code, you just integrate something, you just do something, and that's it. While it may be true for some cases, in many cases, it's not the full scenario. Let's give two examples. Let's say you, Ephraim, signed up to I don't know, let's pick some you know, random tool, signed up to Zoom. You want to use Zoom across the organization. You signed up, you set up your calendar, you set up, you know, everything that is needed. Now you invited me to Zoom. I don't know what Zoom is. Let's say I don't even know what video calling is at all. If you invite me to Zoom and I'm just landing there and I'm trying to think, wait, what's the video conferencing? How do I send a link? Do I need to download something or not? That's another onboarding that should happen. I'm not the account owner. I'm not the one that signed up in the first place, but I'm another user that needs some guidance. And if Zoom will have that guidance over and over, it will just be a resource within the product, not documentation, within the product that says something like, if you're new, you can start here. That's the quick start for everyone along the product. I'll just get there. I'll see, okay, I need to download Zoom used for meetings. You can enable video, you can enable voice, you can record, you can do all of these things. So second time onboarding happens for invited users, which I see in many products being avoided. Like you just fall into a new product and you need to figure out what to do on your own. And Zoom is very simple, by the way. Think of much more complex software that you really don't know what to do with. The second thing is, let's say I'm trying to think of an example. Let's say you're using some sort of, let's take Epsagon. You use it to monitor your environment. And there is your AWS account that you're monitoring, but you have 10 different AWS accounts, one for production, one for pre-production, one for dev and staging and QA and so on. What happens when you're done with development and you want to go now to staging? You can't go back to the onboarding. It's already locked. It's like a one-time thing. But no, you want to have it something that you can always go back and say, I want to integrate another environment. I want to monitor my new environment, my extra environment. So think of that instead of a, you know, like a moving line that you just start and end, more of a flywheel. You can always go back to onboarding. You can always train yourself, whether you're a new person in the company or the account, or you want to bring something new into the product, you can always do that. That really helped us significantly with both new users and expansions. We saw just, you know, users adding more applications, more environments, also inviting more users which are more addicted to Epsagon, more, you know, constantly using it. That really opened up a door to more success, again, all across the board, from conversion to net retention and upselling and cross-selling opportunities, which haven't been before that.
That's wow. That is so important. I even never thought about that aspect of the ongoing onboarding process, something I never even thought about once when it came to PLG. It's so true. How many times do we forget about that?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because like a lot of the things you're mentioning right now, and a lot of the things I've found that go through in general, building a company, you have to learn through trial and error. That's all it is.
Yeah. The more you make the ability for yourself to make more trials and detect the error fast allows you to move faster, because ultimately we're founders, we're people, we're making mistakes. We don't know everything, especially founders, you know, don't know most of the things that they're facing. So being able to try that, make a mistake and move forward, you know, move fast, break things, or make mistakes but make them fast. These are good things, but you really need to stick up to them and don't make a mistake that it's 6 months long. Make it 2 weeks long.
And being able to rectify that quickly. So then what are some of the mistakes you made? And like, you know, part of that whole entire roller coaster ride of the ups and downs over the past 3 years of building the company within the three-year timeframe that you went through.
Yeah. One of them that really burned us was leadership team. At some point in a startup, you know, it stopped being like this, I don't know, 10 or 15 people, not a garage, but not like a fully blown company. It's starting to be 30, 40 people. You need a leadership team. You need people that can own and take accountability for some big areas within Epsagon. These people are very unique people. They're almost as co-founders, like their stakes are almost as co-founders. All the challenges, all the problems, all the headaches, they also get compensated relatively nice as well. But they're not founders. It's really in between. And they need to be very special because they're coming into a specific or a certain stage. Let's say Series A, you're a 40 people company, you're having, I don't know, let's say $1 million in ARR, and their goal is to take you to the next step. Most of these people will be able to take you into the next step, but usually not the step afterwards. So they can take you into Series B or maybe C to $10 million in ARR, but they don't know how to take you into $100 million in ARR. So one thing that we made a mistake is that you can't look for the perfect talent. If you need a VP marketing, bring a VP marketing and not a CMO. CMO will do different things. He looks at on the organization at a different level, or a VP sales and not chief revenue, or a VP product and not chief product. Again, you know, apply to all departments. Someone that will help you at your stage, because there are no jokers. There's no any person that can do 0 to 1 million, 1 million to 10 million, and 10 million to 100 million, and then take you, you know, IPO. These are different type of personas. The other thing which is very important is, especially on early stages, people that know what startup stage is. Startup stage, unlike a successful company, have much more challenges that are, you know, not documented. If you can't sell very good, it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, your salespeople doesn't work so good. It can mean that your product reliability sucks, or you don't have a product market fit, and that's a product problem. It can be a messaging issue coming from the marketing. It can be SDRs that are, you know, not outreaching with the right messaging. It can be a lot of areas which are broken. People, even leaders that are not startup minded, that are, you know, working on a 500 people company that everything already ticks, everything runs smoothly. And it's usually, you know, a very small problem, like AE, account executive, doesn't work so well. We'll try to face it that way. And in a startup, you need to think holistically. And with so many leaders that we have, just looking at the narrow way to solve the problem and not trying to uncover what's the real problem. And that's why you need someone that's been to that stage. For example, let's say you're a Series A company. You need, let's say you need a salesperson. You need to hire a VP sales that's been at that stage, that understands what happens on this stage. Maybe he got to Series B, and that's okay if he didn't go all the way to Series C or IPO or whatever comes next. But he knows these stages. This is something I think that we really burned throughout the years.
It's interesting. It's so true, because, you know, not every person is the right person to get you to the next stage, but also knowing when to move on from those people can be a challenge too.
Yeah, it's a hard hit to the company to, you know, tell a leadership person to go, especially if it's a couple of them or more. But that's the nature of a startup. It's going through an evolution very fast. Unlike, you know, a traditional business that grows very slowly, startups grow, you know, in a year it can turn from 30 employees to 100 employees. That's a different problem. And then the next year to 300 employees, that's another problem as well. Not everyone, most of the people actually can't do all of these stages all together. Some of them might be able to grow into that, but many just can't grow that fast into these new types of.
So then flipping this script into you then, you know, no one's going to fire you. You know, the founders, obviously, how do you grow? How did you grow quickly enough in order to keep yourself skilled and together with scaling with the company?
Yeah, that's, I would say, a relatively right observation, but not, I'll start first that it's not very true. And, you know, a founder can be fired. We hear that it's not a good case because it means that something usually didn't work out in general, but that can happen. I think that at first and foremost, founder should be honest with himself. Can I make up to the work that I'm expected to deliver or I promised to deliver? If you're not good, let's say if you're not a good CEO, you can't manage up to it, or a CTO or a chief product, or, you know, what's the role that you took into yourself? Be honest. Founders can do a lot of things which are not, you know, you can just be a founder to help the company without a proper or a, you know, regular title. That's okay as well. Be honest with yourself if you can't make up to it. The other way around is if you want to grow, you need to learn fast. You can do this by two ways. One is literally learn. You know, if when Nitzan and I started the company, we didn't sell nothing in our life before that. Like, you know, not nothing, but not something related to selling software in 6 or 7 figure deals. We didn't do any product marketing, like messaging or positioning before that. We didn't know how to do that. So we learned. We sat down together and learned how to do these things, how these things works, how competition did this, how friends did this, etc. This is one thing of catching up. And here you need to have a clear distinction between the founders. You don't want both founders to focus on the same point. There is not much time to complete so much work. So you want each one of them to focus on, you know, has his own territory. The second thing, and probably the most important one, is to have mentorship, or I think Asaf Rappaport said it nicer, peership. Take someone that is 1 year or maybe at most 2 years advancing from your road. So if you're a Series A company, pick someone on a Series B, max Series C, to help you. Don't do just one. Do, you know, 3, 5 people that you can call at any time to encounter any problem together, to solve out any issue that comes up. You know, I used to speak with, for example, Nadir from Armis a lot, and Effie from Datorama a lot. They've been super helpful and could, you know, help me on situation. How do you set up a support team? How do you, you know, work with SEs, which are part of the sales team, but very engineering related? How do you work with them? How do you communicate product work to the customer success and sales and marketing teams? Many problems that, you know, as a CTO, I never been a CTO before, but I also haven't faced such problems before. This type of peership, people that are, you know, advancing 1, 2, 3 years at most from where your stage is, it's, you know, valuable. You learn from them a lot. They usually, if they're good people, and usually they're good people because they agreed to help you in some sort of a way, they really like to do this. That's one of the things that, you know, turned me into such a person. I love helping, you know, startups. If a founder sends me a message on LinkedIn and he says, I don't know, I heard you on X speaking about PLG or some topic, and I would love your idea, I would love your help. It's, yeah, let's meet. I want to help you. I want to listen to your story. I would love to help you with whatever way I can. It can be a simple question. It can be an intro. It can be, you know, drilling into some specific topic. They helped me, and, you know, now I'm almost obligated to help other people. So that's the second thing of catching up. If you have the right peership or mentorship next to you, you can just basically address any problem that you can face out.
I hope people bombard your inbox after hearing this.
I hope so too, actually. I really hope so. It's a pleasure to learn about other people's stories. And it's, you know, to me, it's an opportunity to learn about someone that is facing some challenge and is actually sending me a message to be able to help him. It's not, you know, it's not taken for granted.
You mentioned Nadir, so I'm going to obviously give a shout out to Nadir. Nadir's amazing, such a dear friend. And we actually had the opportunity to finally sit together and record an episode 2 days back. And it's such a big testament. And, you know, that's one of the biggest things about the entrepreneurship community, where it's everyone trying to support each other. Because everyone's been through the same challenges, similar to challenges, but obviously in their own narrative. And the only way that this entrepreneurship community evolves and continues to grow is when founders are supporting other founders. Mm-hmm. That's really how it happens.
Yeah.
So how did the resiliency of, you know, building the startup translate into your own personal life? So what are some of the emotional aspects of it, or other different types of things that you apply to other things too?
I want to share a story. Through the startup, before the startup, I wasn't even engaged. I remember that we started to approach the first VCs. I said, let's propose to Netta, my wife. So I'll either way be a winner. Either I'll manage to raise funds, or she'll say yes, and I'll be, you know, engaged and then married. This was my strategy. Luckily, both of them succeeded. So I kind of went into both forefronts. I'm saying forefronts not because it's hard or it's a war, but because it's demanding. Both of them demanding, you know, 100% attention, and you're just a single person. And, you know, you also have your parents and friends and other commitments general to the life. But it consumes a lot. You need to, there's not a right formula. You know, in many cases, it doesn't go so well. People, I hear many founder stories that are divorcing. One thing that's worth sharing is that having an open communication about it. You know, I told Netta, look, in the next years, it can be 3 years, it can be, I don't know, 7 years. It's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult for us. I'm not, you know, I'll probably have some days that I'll get back very late. When I'm open, I won't just waste time on work. I'll come back, you know, from work early so we can have fun. Let's try to force ourselves, or not force, but make as a commitment that, you know, every week or so we'll get out together, our own personal time. I think we managed to balance our, you know, work life relatively good. Again, there's been highs and lows, just as in a startup, just as working with Nitzan, just as living with my wife, Netta. It's, you know, it's a roller coaster. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not good. It's especially good when all three are on the rise. And it's the worst when all three are down, because, you know, when you're down at home, you're down at work, you're down with your partner, with your friends. So you need to, you know, juggle between them. The last addition to the family, Tevel, my baby, was really, you know, exciting. It's, if you're giving 100% to the startup and another 100% to my wife, then Tevel takes, I don't know, another 500% of capacity for me emotionally and, you know, physically. But then again, there, I guess there is some sort of a magical way to make things tension together, like, you know, make things work together. Be open, be always communicative. I always tell Netta that I'm probably not the perfect husband, but I always speak out loud about challenges. I'm not letting ourselves, you know, going into sleep when we're fighting. We'll speak about it. I'll tell her, look, Netta, I know that something bad happened or something didn't work out today. Either it's the baby or me or you. But let's speak about it. When we're speaking about it, we're not delaying problems. That's also the same approach that I'm doing with the startup or now even Cisco. When there is a problem, I'm speaking about it. I'm not letting it go down. I hate when things are not surfacing up quickly. I would also say that it's almost like a culture thing in our company. When there is a problem, people are surfacing it very quickly. When something, you know, happens unculturally, like not in the right way of the culture, people surface it very quickly, which, again, it's valuable because you don't let rotten things grow into the company. So being a very open and very communicative about it helped. And again, I might be saying, you know, all seems to bloom. Like, you know, in 4 years, I went from a single person to, you know, a husband plus one and a father, and from no startup to an exit and so many things. It's hard to juggle between all of them.
It sounds like a good story. Like, I love how you did the last end of it, you know, starting off single, finding the love of his life, having a baby at the same time, being able to build and sell a company. It sounds great.
Yeah. I'm actually a quantum run. One run went into the startup world. The other one went into the family world, and both of them met after 3.5 years or 4 years and reunited with both, you know, both ends.
So one thing I like to mention at the end is that, you know, when we ruminate a lot about issues and don't have that conversation and bring up the issues to the surface, what happens is obviously these are expectations that have been unmet, or these are agreements that have not been agreed upon, which will eventually lead to resentments. And then eventually when that conversation does happen, it's happening in the form of an argument or in the form of pointing fingers and just blaming each other. Communication, especially in a startup, I mean, forget about it, relationships is number one, obviously. You know, if you don't have communication in a relationship, then you're totally done. But specifically within a startup, it's just so important. And this relates also back to feedback, the whole feedback loop between manager and another team member, or between everybody and everything there.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have a lot to say on that.
Yeah. As a founder, I found it interesting. If you encounter a challenge, speak about it, share it with the right people, and understand how to improve yourself. Just as you're doing it for the product, you found a problem, you talk about it, you look at the data, and you solve it together. Likewise, you know, there has been probably a few times that Nitzan and my communication weren't being at the best, and it's impacted the whole company, you know, because there has been, let's say, some problem with some department and we didn't spoke about it, and you know, it could be a couple months and nothing happened and it didn't work well. But on the other end, when we spoke about it openly and freely and shared the problem and got into an agreement, it can be an argument, a good argument with, you know, more of a debating type of argument where you share data, the other side share data, you speak into what should be the right results, and you come into agreement in a form of expectations from one another. That's the way to succeed. And, you know, it's, I'm taking it into the founder side, but as you mentioned, a team lead and his person, I don't know, product and a team lead, VP product and VP marketing, VP sales and VP customer success. There are so many connections within the company that needs to solve problems. If you're coming to a startup as any type of employee, founder, team lead, sales, whatever, you need to make sure that you're aware that you're going to a challenge-full environment. If you're thinking about a corporate that it's almost challenge-free, you know, you can relax, you can take a day off and nothing will happen. If you're taking a day off in a startup at any point where you are, you're probably piling up yourself with, you know, double more challenges, and every day is a different challenge, and you need to work out through these challenges and not try to, you know, ignore it. No, it's not a snoozing problem. It's a, how fast can I encounter the challenges, speak about them and fix them, so I'll be able to fix the other problem and get into the other challenge.
I totally hear that, agree with that. It's just like when you're having that crucial conversation, like don't start jumping from one thing to the next. Focus on the crucial thing at hand, and from there move on to the next thing. Yeah. But moving forward, you know, now that you sold the company, what does social impact mean to you right now? I mean, you achieve what every founder wants to achieve, what most people want to achieve, and you know, Baruch Hashem, you're not worried about how you're going to put food on the table anymore. You know, and you're able to really set yourself up. So what does making an impact mean to you now?
Yeah. Jacques, one of our investors, shared a nice story, but, you know, in a very short way, it's trying to make positive impacts for whoever and however you can do this. And I took it in Cisco. There is a really great attitude into volunteering, into giving back to the community. For them, it's a measurement. You know, it's a KPI that they're looking to have. So, you know, there are a few simple things. Things like donate money. It's the easiest form of helping. I really like, you know, understanding what's a story that I can relate to that I can donate. And Cisco matches your donation. So it's really nice. You're like, I don't know, you're donating $1,000 and Cisco matches it immediately. That's one way of thinking of it. Second way of, you know, making a positive impact is helping, you know, goes back to our story. I'm a founder. I'm seeing many seed stage founders or even pre-seed. And, you know, I'm happy to help them. It's really, it's almost ignites me from within to help, you know, early founders on their journey. It's like, you know, I'm almost watching myself and, you know, accomplishing my dream through them. So that's another way of helping. And again, I said this before. If you're a founder and you need help with something that you think I can help with, LinkedIn, and I'll answer. I never miss, you know, some sort of a communication there. The other part is, I would say, more community involvement. That might be tricky. And that's something that on the high tech scene, especially in corporates, I would say there is a lot of waste, just like food or any other thing. There's lots of technical waste or even waste of hours being spent on something not important that can be leveraged to people that don't have this. A few communities that we helped along this with these ways, Zikaron Basalon, that promotes the memorial of Holocaust through technical ways and even technological ways and even, you know, physically. Meet for Life, which is helping lone soldiers to find their way through the labor force and potentially also the tech-related industry. So, you know, you switch a laptop every 3 years or so in a company. Usually these laptops are great. You know, it's a three-year-old Mac. It can work even for 5 more years. It's probably, you know, the strongest, like i7, lots of RAM, lots of, you know, space. People can really use it. People that don't have the access to such luxury, for them, they're probably either not using even a laptop at all, or the laptop that they're using is, I don't know, 15 years old. It's still running Windows XP or something. And for them to run a Mac, it's, you know, it's, and for us, it's like, wait, I don't have this Mac. If I wouldn't give it, it would just, I don't know, just wait there and do nothing. So I think it's an opportunity, whether it's this type of equipment, screens, any type of equipment. And for ours, it's something that we found out. People are starving to learn from our experience. So, you know, as a founder, I'm helping two founders, but we can also help in teaching them Kubernetes, teaching them cloud, teaching them Python. These communities sometimes just don't know where to start. They don't know how to get access to this information. And with an hour of a session for a few people, you can really change their life. So also devoting time to that, it's something that, again, to me, it's an opportunity, because finding the right people that want to get help from you, it's not always easy. So these are a few things that we're making as a positive impact outside of our day-to-day, you know, boring, nerdy, geeky day-to-day in front of our screens, developing microservices on Kubernetes, on AWS, etc. Yeah,
we don't realize the impact that we can have on someone else. We could literally change someone else's life.
Yeah.
Literally change. So yeah. What do we tell a young Ron, you know, 21-year-old Ron that's facing the role for the first time, and he has multiple opportunities in front of him, and he can do whatever he wants? He could become a software engineer for Cisco, Facebook, Google, or some other major company, Wix, Monday, sit behind the screen and just go ahead all day. You could go ahead and travel the world. You could become working at a local cafe over there. What message do we tell the young Ron facing the role for the first time?
Choose opportunities over anything else. Opportunity to me is something that it will be rare to achieve again. For example, having a good salary, it's something that you'll probably just get better and better throughout the years. Being in the comfort zone, it's something that you can always go back to. But venturing together with a partner that you know for a long time and you're both in sync on the goal, it's an opportunity. It's being able, and you know, at the same time, because I see many founders, you know, waiting for someone to get out from his commitment in order to get to that. So being able to jump into opportunities, that's the most meaningful, you know, way. That's how I got into being a group leader, like a group engineering manager. That's how I decided to go with Mitsan. I had, you know, even without really looking out, I had a few other offers, but that was the most opportunistic. And even now with Cisco, my opportunity is to see how things grow at the scale of the biggest corporate, at the scale of, you know, instead of just 20, 30 engineers, get to 100 engineers, get to a business unit that sells, I can't even imagine, sell for $100 million. To me, it's a challenge and it's an opportunity, and I'm taking it with two hands. Many people tell me, have you already started to, you know, to count out the days? No, I'm not counting out the days. If I'll get to a point where I'm starting to count the days, this will be my last day. I'm not working, as you mentioned, I'm not working to bring food to the table. I'm working to challenge myself, and this is my current opportunity to grow into something, to do something meaningful.
Incredible. Nissan, I want to thank you. Sorry, Ron. You mentioned Nissan again.
Right. You also want to thank Nissan because he's the one, like together we got into this place. I mean, you know, alone, Nissan and myself are really complimenting each other on a lot of ways. And I owe at least 50% of this success to him as well, if not more, actually.
Yeah, and we're gonna have to have him on the show too.
Yeah.
Ron, I want to thank you. First of all, I value our relationship and friendship very much, but also for this conversation now. I've learned a tremendous amount, and I know no doubt it's going to help the thousands of people that are going to listen to this conversation and get inspired. And I hope you also get bombarded with thousands of messages on LinkedIn. But I know it's going to help multiple people, myself included. I was able to learn a lot of different things, everything from different aspects of PLG. Also from your, you know, for me always, it's not the actual conversation that's happening, but it's the conversation under the conversation, where I'm able to take out those messages. And that's where I personally listened for and listened to over there. So it's the emotional feelings that I feel within my body, the vulnerability that's been expressed that you're not able, that only underlying type of thing. And I felt a lot of that throughout our conversation, able to pick up multiple different things that I am going to have to obviously sit upon and think about and contemplate how I can implement that into my own life. So I want to thank you so much. It was an absolute honor and pleasure. And I know we're going to have to do many more of these because you have so much to share. And I'm looking forward to your book eventually. And I know this is just the start of your journey. And you're going to go ahead and accomplish a lot of incredible things and make a huge impact in this world. So thank you.
Thanks, Ephraim. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Again, it's a great opportunity to be hosted here, to share the story. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Ron and you learned something that you're able to apply to your personal or professional life today. Now, before you go, please subscribe and leave a review. And if you have any friends that could benefit from listening to this conversation, don't forget to share it with them too. Thank you and have a great week.